Our star guests today are a husband and wife piano and vocal duo known for their cabaret-style performances where they blend musical virtuosity with comedy. Their musical styles range from jazz and show tunes to original compositions, and they're MAC Award winners. Well, Mardy Millett and Michael Garin are together. They're joining us on the programme now, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to Community Connections. Mardy, Michael, welcome to the programme.
Hi, Andrew.
Thank you so much. We're delighted to be here.
Yeah, this is great.
Let's start with the obvious question, I think. When you're working as a couple, is it easier?
Certain things are easier. For one thing, I don't have to pay for a piano player. That's wonderful. There's also, for me, the unbelievable gift of the fact that Michael Garin can play by ear. So if I play a recording of a song for him, as long as there's a recording of the song I want him to learn, he only has to listen to it a couple of times, and then he can play it in literally any key. I have not had to carry sheet music with me in about 20 years. We've known each other that long, and we've been working together since we first met. So now, as to the cons, he could probably give you a longer list than I could because he has to work with me.
Did music bring you together? Did you meet through music?
Yes, we did. There is a weekly open mic at Birdland called Jim Caruso's Cast Party. And we had both started going to it. Actually, Mardy was one of the original people that started going to it. It was part of its inception. And I started going a little later, and we sort of ran into each other. And both of our previous marriages, unfortunately, were on their way out.
We started working together musically before we became a couple.
Yeah.
Life is messy, especially when you're over 40. Everybody has baggage, don't they? And we kind of knew that was where it was going. We were both at the ends of our first marriages, which we did our best. We all did our best, didn't we? Yeah.
And so I was at that point pretty much exclusively singing satirical or comedic songs that I had written. And I can't mention that genre without a shout out to Tom Lehrer, who just left the stage and really sort of set the standard for anybody who thinks that through music you can get a laugh, because he was truly the master. I have a feeling he's with Flanders and Swann right now, cooking something up.
Yeah.
But I did one of my songs, and Mardy did one of her songs, and it was, you know, we just kind of caught each other's eye.
We started telling each other musician jokes, actually, at the bar.
Yeah, and almost got thrown out.
Yeah, we were laughing so hard at each other's jokes that we were shushed many times. So we laughed.
Mardy, where did your musical interest come from? Has it been with you from a child?
Yes. My mother kept a, you know, a baby book from my infancy. And one of the first entries was that I was singing all the time. And I sang before I could talk. And when I was about 4 years old, going through my parents' LP collection, I just dated myself. I picked out a different record, one that I hadn't heard before. It had a cartoon on it, so I thought it must be a kid's record. But in fact, it was the original cast album of My Fair Lady. Once I heard that, that was it.
Michael, what about you? Where does your musical heritage come from?
Well, I grew up, I'm a first generation American, and my parents escaped the Nazis and went to Israel and then came here. So we had a very odd mix of Marlene Dietrich, Edith Piaf, Theodore Bickel, and also cast albums of Broadway shows and stuff. So some of my first memories, my parents were very insistent that my sister and I and everybody go to the theater. And there is nothing like the lights coming down and the orchestra beginning the overture, because that what I loved about musical theater then and now is that it's one-stop shopping. You get dancing, you get orchestras, you get singing, you get stories, you get it's everything. Why go to all these different things when you can go to one show You get everything taken care of, and then you can go home and have lunch.
That's always been the thing for me too, though. But that's, I would say, because it's so magical that you, it, to me, it's magic to have all of those things in one art form.
And that's why it's only natural that we end up creating a new musical together.
Oh, that's true. We've written a new musical together.
Yeah.
We will come on to talk about that in a little bit. But what I did want to explore with you is this wonderful relationship through letters that you had with the wonderful Stephen Sondheim.
Yes, I wrote him a fan letter when I was 13 or 14 years old, and as he did with just about every letter he ever received, he wrote back. But this was in the days before he was as big a deal as he came to be. It's hard for my younger friends to understand that there was a time when Stephen Sondheim was, he was known, but only among the cognoscenti of musical theater in New York City. And he was not a superstar at that time. So for me to get access to him was not as unbelievable a feat as it sounds now in retrospect, 40 some years on. But we had a correspondence that the timing of it was just perfect, and that was just luck. It was right around the time that he was writing Merrily We Roll Along, which was originally going to be cast with young teenagers, which is what I was. So I think there was a little bit of a professional interest in getting to know a teenager so he could sort of pick my brain for character. And also because that show was a huge flop and it was his biggest flop, he lost a lot of friends over that, because that's how showbiz is, you know, it's very fickle. And I wrote to him because I, another stroke of luck, I happened to see the final performance of Merrily We Roll Along on Broadway, the original production. And I wrote to him and said, I don't understand what happened. I think the critics are out of their minds. I loved it. And I mean, I was telling the truth. I always told the truth. I've never been able to suck up to anybody. I probably would have had a better career if I had. But I'm telling the truth. I said, I loved it. And he wrote back and said, you know, so many of my friends have dropped me, and I want to thank you for being a true friend. And that strengthened our friendship.
Do you feel, in a way, that you had an influence on Stephen Sondheim?
I would never dare to go that far, but I do know that he had so many friends in so many wide-ranging parts of life. And he was always a student of life. So I know that all of his friendships influenced him because he always kept his mind and his heart open to every experience in his life. So that's as far as I would venture, is to say that I know he considered me a friend, as well as hundreds of other people, some of whom I also know. I think we all influenced him, and I think we were all blessed to have that channel open with him whenever we were communicating with him.
There are some people that really affect your life, and Stephen Sondheim, I think, has touched the lives of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people all the way around the world. Michael, the letters that Mardy swapped with Stephen Sondheim led eventually to this production of Sorry, Grateful.
Yeah. And I will be upfront that I was not as big of a fan as Marty was. And it really it took under her tutelage, and she showed remarkable patience with me.
Did.
Trust me. And I eventually found a way to connect to the material in a way that was not like everybody else's, because I come from a completely different musical way of thinking, and I had to find my way to get to the Sondheim music and lyrics in a way that was honest for him and honest for me. And what I found was there was a the through line that I found was that many of his songs to me felt like a machine that was trying to turn into a flower. In other words, there was an internal mechanism that was very finely and meticulously put together, but what it really wanted to be when it grew up was a beautiful blossom. And you had to sort of, and I had to find my musical way of expressing that metamorphosis, which I found in a tremendous amount of his work. And I found that my background in particularly dance-oriented pop music led me to give it a. I gave him, you know, there was there's a series of attempts to sort of bring jazz to Sondheim. I tried to bring funk to Sondheim. So rather than try to sound like a Spyro Gyra doing Sondheim, I wanted to sound like the Ohio Players. And that was the way for me to connect to the material by putting some junk in the trunk, as they say. So, and it seemed to have worked out quite well.
It worked very well, and I was as skeptical of Michael's approach as Michael was initially skeptical of Sondheim's entire oeuvre of work. And the cool thing about that is he gave Sondheim a chance, and I gave him a chance to create his own arrangements, and it ended up informing my own understanding and performance of songs that I've known since I was a teenager. So Michael has forever changed the way that I sing Sorry Grateful, the song from Company, which is the title of our show. And every other song that's in that show, Michael has changed the way I perform it and the way I think of it. We do Anyone Can Whistle.
Yeah.
And Michael mashes it up with an instrumental of David Bowie's Life on Mars. I would never have thought of that in a million years, but what's great about it is that is it reminded me of a story from my own childhood. And what I put in the patter was people said that Sondheim's music and lyrics were cold and unfeeling. What I heard was a kid who knows what it feels like to be an alien in your own home. And then we go into Anyone Can Whistle and Life on Mars. And it made that I'm getting chills talking about it because he found that those two songs went together harmonically and melodically. And to me, that juxtaposition created an emotional moment that was already there. I just had to discover it. That's when cabaret works the best.
It really is taking Stephen Sondheim's music and taking it up to another level, and perhaps a level that even Sondheim himself wouldn't have realized it could go.
I like to think he would have enjoyed what we did.
I like to think he was listening from wherever he is now.
I always felt when I was performing Sorry Grateful, and we are going to be performing it again. At the very least, we'll be performing it in January in Sarasota, Florida. But I always felt when I was performing that show that Steve was sort of just behind my right shoulder. But, you know, I'm kind of a woo-woo, airy-fairy, boho, hippie chick.
Let us, as I promised, talk about your latest project. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, we live in Harlem, as Marty had mentioned. And I had noticed for the last 9 years, I've had the been lucky enough to have a full-time job playing at the Roxy Hotel in Tribeca. But before that happened, there was this little French bistro near our apartment that had a piano in the bar. And it took me about a year and a half, maybe more, to get the guy to give me a couple of nights. I said, I live in the neighborhood. I'm a piano player. People know who I am. It could work. Finally, he gave us a handful of Thursday nights. And on one of those Thursday nights, An older gentleman comes up to the piano and he requests "I Can't Get Started," which I was happy to play for him. And then he came back and said, "My companion and I are really enjoying the way you play. Have you ever thought about writing a musical? I wrote this book. It might make a good musical." And I thought, "Who is this guy?" And I gave him my card, and that night I got an email from the world famous illustrator Ed Sorel, whose work I've always enjoyed, but I had no idea what he looked like, nor did I need to. And he sent me the galleys of the most extraordinary book called Mary Astor's Purple Diary, The Great American Sex Scandal of 1936. One paragraph in, and I went, "Holy, you know what? I got a tiger by the tail." And it was a story, if you can imagine a rom-com written by Kurt Vonnegut, that's kind of what this was. And it's a fantastic book. And I read it and I said, "I can do this. I know how to turn this into a musical." Well, Ed had somebody he wanted to write the script. I was doing music and lyrics. That guy didn't work out. Terrific writer, but not suited for this project. I found someone, another terrific writer, not suited for this project. It didn't work out.
Meanwhile,
Meanwhile,
COVID happened. We're all stuck inside, but we still have a contract. He still has a contract with Ed. He has to have a professional presentation of the show by
such and such a day.
August 1st of 2022. So it's 2021 at this point, and we're still in lockdown. And our director, Carl Andrus, who is Charles Bush's collaborator, by the way, says to me, "You know, Marty, maybe you could just write a synopsis. Just write a synopsis of the plot as you and Michael see it." Because neither of the other book writers was able to sort of embrace the magical realism concept that Michael had originally had for the show. And I said, "Sure, I can write a synopsis. It'll be like Goddard Lieberson writing liner notes for My Fair Lady," right? Because everything goes back to My Fair Lady. So I started writing the synopsis. And the characters began speaking to me. They just started talking. And I started taking dictation. And the next thing I know, I had an entire scene between Mary and Ed. And I said, "I think that I'm going to be writing a draft of the book." And they said, "Sure, go ahead." I minored in creative writing in college, but it was poetry. So I thought, I've been in a lot of musicals. I've certainly read a lot of musicals. I don't think I know what I'm doing, but it was COVID and all of the guardrails were off, right? So why not me, right? Why not me? So I wrote a draft, and by that time, some of the restrictions were lifted, and Carl came over to our apartment, and Michael played through all the songs, and Carl and I read all of the dialogue together. And when we finished, I thought he was going to say, "Marty, thank you for getting us to this point. We're now ready to find a real playwright that we can hand this off to." And instead, Carl said, "I think we're in pretty good shape. I have some notes and I'd like to see another draft in like a month." And I was like, "You're kidding me. I'm not getting fired." So that's how I became a playwright.
as the process continued, and I wrote and changed some songs and cut some songs and added some songs and doing some stuff, I remember we went to see the show about Oscar Levant, Good Night Oscar, and Ed was with us, and I think he got the tickets, and he was with a friend of his, and we all met outside the theater, and he actually said, "This is Marty Millett. She saved the show," and she really did, because when I read the book, I thought, "Yeah, there's all this Hollywood stuff going on, and there's this sort of really kind of the first reality television before there was television, insanity and mass media event." And I said, "But at the end of the day, this is a conversation between two individuals."
You can hear all of the songs. Our website is maryastermusical.com. And you can read a synopsis of the story that I wrote. You can look at a bunch of Ed Sorrell's gorgeous illustrations. And you can hear the fantastic Kate Baldwin as Mary Astor. And Michael and I are playing almost all of the other roles.
Yeah, but our friends Max Crumb and Edward Huvier are in on it. The show is a fairy tale for grown-ups.
I honestly think in this day and age, we need all the fairy tales for grown-ups that we can get. Mardi and Michael, I'm so sorry we are running right out of time, but it's been an absolute pleasure. Can I thank you both so much for joining us? And please, will you come back on again sometime? Because I think we've only just scratched the surface of all the stories you've got.
We've had a delightful time talking to you. Thank you so
Thank you
much.
so much.
Mardi Millett, Michael Guerin, the very best of luck. Thank you for joining us from New York.
Thank you.
If you ever plan to motor west,
and what if I do?
Travel my way, take that highway, that's the best.
Who are you, Rand McNally?
And Rand McNally. Get your kicks on Route 66.
The Atlas Shrugged.
Hey,
get it?
I live wines from Chicago to LA.
We're smart people.
More than 2,000 miles all the way.
Like the small intestine.
Get your kicks. Thanks for sharing on Route 66.
I like to educate.
Well, it goes through the Louis, Joplin, Missouri, and Oklahoma City. Kicks on Route 66. Ba-da-boo-ba-doo.
Zabba-da-da.